Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, Election Day is now over. It's time to sift through the results. Illinois' Democratic governor wanted a graduated income tax, but voters said no. What does that mean for J.B. Pritzker?
It absolutely hurts the governor's political capital. You don't just run for governor and put an amendment like this on the ballot, see it fail, and then walk away unscathed.
While Donald Trump might have hampered Republicans in some areas of the state, were Democrats hurt by one of their leaders here in Illinois? We'll hear about some reasons why one of the closest congressional races in the country last election was not as tight this time around. Also, a researcher discusses what he's found about small businesses and the impact of COVID-19 restrictions. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. You're tuned in to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll talk about the election results in Illinois. Did the Illinois House Speaker, Michael Madigan, hurt Democrats in some races? We'll find out how the pandemic has impacted churchgoers, and a researcher takes a look at COVID-19 restrictions on small businesses. That and more ahead on Statewide. While voters gave a thumbs down to changing Illinois' constitution and swapping a flat income tax for a graduated tax system, this was a really expensive race in the dueling campaigns for and against. There were echoes of past attempts at tax reform in Illinois, as Hannah Meisel looked back at the 1990s, the 1970s, and even the 1930s for some lessons in failed tax changes.
The year was 1994. Democrat Don Clark Netsch, then the state's comptroller, was running against Republican Governor Jim Edgar.
We needed to do two things. One, make a much stronger commitment to public education. And second, we have to find a better way to pay for it.
That's Netsch, 2 years before her death in 2013. Then, as now, Illinois was struggling to adequately fund its schools, and a top concern among Illinois voters was property tax relief. Most funding for local schools comes from property taxes, and not from the state. As a result, Illinois has long had some of the highest property tax burdens in the nation. Netsch's so-called tax swap would have raised Illinois' individual income tax rate in exchange for property tax relief, because schools could then be funded primarily through state tax dollars, something Netsch said was a constitutional mandate. She should know, she got it into the state's constitution as a delegate to the 1970 Constitutional Convention. But the courts ruled the Constitution's school funding language was merely a suggestion and not ironclad. Enter the tax swap.
We needed to do it because we could pay for it out of a broader-based, fairer tax structure.
That word fair, sound familiar? It's central to Governor Pritzker's messaging on the graduated income tax proposal, which he dubbed the fair tax on the campaign trail. Here's University of Illinois political scientist David Merriman.
Both of them are focused on, you know, what's fair. And I think a lot of people feel that the school funding system is, you know, terribly, terribly unfair. And now I think a lot of people feel that the income distribution is terribly unfair.
Implicit in Pritzker's tax plan is the fact that income inequality in America has been growing in recent decades. In fact, many economists point to the 1970s as the decade in which economic growth in the U.S. began to slow and the income gap widened. Charlie Wheeler is a longtime State House observer and covered the 1970 Constitutional Convention as a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. He says the framers of the Constitution could not have predicted the future.
Back in 1970, the gap between the bottom 10% and the top 10% was a heck of a lot smaller than it is now. And so there wasn't that same level of concern.
Wheeler also remembers some fatigue around the income tax issue by the time the convention rolled around. Just the year before, then-Governor Richard Ogilvie and Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley struck a deal to implement a flat-rate state income tax. Those working on that issue in 1969 had to be careful not to run afoul of a Great Depression-era decision from the Illinois Supreme Court, which struck down Illinois' first attempt at an income tax. If you can believe it, that attempt was actually a graduated income tax, and it was proposed by a conservative Republican governor and opposed by Chicago Democrats. But the state's high court struck it down. Wheeler said after the state Supreme Court upheld the 1969 flat tax, delegates wanted to move on to settling other elements of the Constitution.
the majority of the delegates, as I recall, decided, well, why don't we just embody what's already in law and not get into this whole income tax fight again?
UIC's Merriman says that as much as income inequality has increased in the last quarter century, so has distrust of state government.
And I think now there is even less trust, you know, which is kind of at war with the fairness idea, and that those things are put against each other.
In the 1994 campaign, Edgar and Republicans used distrust of Netsch's plan as a winning strategy.
Netsch has a plan to increase the income tax by 42%.
26 years later, opponents to Pritzker's graduated income tax plan have nicknamed it the Tax Hike Amendment and are using Illinois' history of fiscal problems as evidence to not trust those behind it. Here's a campaign ad that's been playing nonstop on airwaves across Illinois in the last few weeks of election season.
I'm deeply concerned about the Tax Hike Amendment. They claim they're only going to increase taxes on the rich, but if their out-of-control spending tells us anything, they'll be back for more. I don't trust Springfield politicians to be fair to taxpayers. Do you?
Back in 1994, Edgar won re-election in a landslide. But 2 years later, a commission he appointed to study the interplay between school funding and property taxes proposed a plan strikingly similar to Netsch's tax swap. However, after passing the Illinois House, it was killed in the state Senate by a fellow Republican. I'm Hannah Meisel.
Governor J.B. Pritzker appeared quite agitated after voters went against his graduated tax proposal. He spoke to reporters this week and recalled how he inherited a state with some of the worst budget problems in the country.
And in my first major address as governor nearly 2 years ago, I laid out our three paths forward with regard to the budget. Option one, immediately make billions of dollars in cuts. Let me offer some context to that. Already, the state of Illinois invests, on average, less money per capita than the majority of states. That's not to suggest that we can't find significant cost reductions. We've been doing that. But if you think cutting government alone is the solution, remember this. If you set aside federally protected programs, court-ordered obligations, and our bond and pension debt, we would have to reduce discretionary spending in our state by approximately 15%. That's 15% fewer state troopers. That's 15% fewer students going to college. 15% fewer working parents receiving child care assistance. And 15% less money for your local public schools, which likely means that your property taxes will increase. You could call this the Republican approach. Option two. Raise revenue within our current regressive flat tax system and impose a higher flat tax, which falls disproportionately on the working poor and the middle class. Option three was the fair tax, an option that people have talked about in Illinois for decades because few other states use the antiquated flat tax system. And while the fair tax would have helped to address our budget crisis with the least damage to the working families of Illinois, the millionaires and billionaires opposed it to protect their own wallets, deceiving the public about its purpose, and they ended up prevailing. Sometimes politics works against the best solutions. It's no surprise these are the same people who pushed for Bruce Rauner's agenda and will resurrect his failed crusade any way they can. So let me just say to the people of Illinois, you deserved a fairer tax system, and you still do. But that didn't happen. So here we are. I have not given up the battle to balance our budget and to put the state on firm fiscal footing. I will work with the legislature to implement structural solutions to our decades-long budget woes. But I will never forget that some of the wealthiest and most powerful interests in Illinois did everything in their power to put the burden of this on workers and their families instead of shouldering some of the burden themselves. Illinois' fiscal problems haven't gone away. In the coming days, I'll be talking with the leaders in the General Assembly about our path forward, but here's what we know for sure. I promised to be a governor who balances the budget and pays the bills that my predecessor left behind. I promised to make sure that our kids get a good education, that we invest in job creation, and that we build a better future for Illinois. There will be cuts, and they will be painful. And the worst thing is, the same billionaires who lied to you about the fair tax are more than happy to hurt our public schools, shake the foundations of our cities, and diminish our state.
Governor J.B. Pritzker speaking on Wednesday after the defeat of his graduated income tax plan. Kent Redfield is a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois Springfield, and for decades he's followed campaigns and political spending. He joined us to further discuss what happened during the recent election in Illinois. Kent, let's start at the top. There was an effort to change how Illinois taxes income. It would have had to change the Constitution for that to take effect, from a flat income tax rate to a graduated tax system. You followed the money. Plenty was poured into this issue on both sides. It failed to win support. Did one side just sell their message better?
You know, obviously when you've got $125 million, which is, just for comparison, the Rauner Quinn general election cost about $105 million. So this was a huge amount of money. We've never seen this kind of money spent on a, you know, constitutional amendment, a ballot question. And I think the argument on the pro side was both an equity kind of public finance argument and then kind of an appeal to enlightened self-interest. You know, state needs revenue. They got to get it from somewhere. You know, why not take it from the other guy rather than you? And while both of those kind of, let's be fair and equitable, in the short term, you can protect your interests by raising taxes on the other guy, you know, those seem like pretty strong arguments, but clearly an appeal to people's lack of faith, mistrust, aversion to Illinois politics and Illinois political leaders turned out to be the stronger argument. You know, you can't trust these guys. They've lied to you in the past. You know, and therefore, you know, you need to, you know, send a message to Springfield. That was a very strong message. I don't think this is necessarily a referendum on Governor Pritzker, although it certainly hurts his ability to write a budget and to deal with the state's fiscal situation in the coming cycle and, you know, cycles. I would think that indirectly it was a repudiation of the Speaker of the House and kind of the way that the politics that he represents, that's been building, you know, it was a constant theme with Governor Rauner. You know, I think that was a significant factor, even though I don't think they ever mentioned the Speaker's name in any of the ads that they were running. They were running against the kind of politics that people have come to characterize, you know, Madigan being the symbol of.
Speaker Michael Madigan, he's also the chair of the Illinois Democratic Party, which means he plays a role in every election, especially when it comes to where money is allocated in certain races. One of the big ones that came up this time was the Illinois Supreme Court. There was a race to retain Thomas Kilbright, a justice on the Supreme Court, and he failed to receive enough support to do that. Was that a blow to Madigan?
Not personally. I mean, it doesn't make it easier, directly harder or easier for him to get reelected speaker, but again, he was the main villain in the narrative that the anti-Kilbright people were putting forth. And again, huge funding from Ken Griffin, the richest man in Illinois, and Richard Euland, who's been a longtime feature of conservative politics. You know, they were the money behind the anti-Kilbright campaign, but the message was that Kilbride was tied to corrupt Madigan politics. You know, they apparently had enough money left over. You know, they spent $4.5 million against Kilbride. It looks like they had enough money left over to spend at least $1.5 million against the Democratic candidate down in the 5th district, where Overstreet, the Republican, replaced the retiring Carmier. You know, the brand of the Democratic Party is becoming, in the public's mind, more and more associated with the Speaker.
Well, when we look at the state overall, I know a lot of people were expecting a Democratic sweep, and that even includes a lot of Republicans I had talked to before. They were very concerned coming into this race, and yet we really didn't see that happen, that Republicans were wiped off the map, and we even saw a congressional race in the central Illinois that went heavier to the Republican candidate, the incumbent Rodney Davis. He won by more than last time over the same opponent. So I guess I have to ask, was the death of the Republican Party in Illinois exaggerated?
Well, the total demise was exaggerated. I mean, there's still considerable strength in, outside of the Chicago and Cook County and the close-in suburbs. The further you get out into the northeastern Illinois, there's still strength there in the Republican Party. And I think the Londrigan Davis race in the 13th here in central Illinois, that's an indication of, one, downstate is growing more and more conservative. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. And there's an awful lot of conservative territory within the 13th district, and the pandemic may have had an impact on turnout and Davis's margin in Champaign County. I mean, he almost lost 2 years ago because of the huge margin that came out of Champaign County. But again, the dominant narrative that was being pushed at the end of that campaign was not about healthcare and not about the pandemic. It was about they were making the case that there were ties between Betsy Lonergan and the Speaker of the House and his political operation. I had a friend who said, after watching those commercials, I was pretty sure, that Betsy Lonergan must be Madigan's adopted daughter, in terms of what they were trying to do with the constant hammering of that theme. And so I think that, I think, again, the speaker's presence may have been more of a drag than Trump was in some of those suburban races, and certainly downstate.
Kent Redfield is a professor emeritus with the University of Illinois Springfield, and he joined us here on Statewide. Still ahead, for many, going to church has changed during the pandemic. That story still on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a researcher looks at other states and small businesses impacted by the pandemic and COVID-19 restrictions. One of the most watched congressional races in the country was right here in Illinois, in the 13th District, which includes much of central Illinois and into the Metro East area near St. Louis. If you were surprised by the size of Congressman Rodney Davis's margin of victory over his two-time Democratic challenger, you're not alone. So was Davis. Ryan Denham reports on some of the reasons why that happened.
Davis beat Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan 2 years ago by just 2,000 votes, a 1% margin. It was one of the closest races in the country. And this year, many political analysts considered the 13th Congressional District a toss-up. Instead, the Republican Davis expanded his margin of victory considerably. He won with 55% of the vote, a nearly 30,000 vote margin. Davis's critics argued he was too closely aligned with President Donald Trump. Now, Davis says his victory shows just how popular Trump is in his district.
You saw a surge in areas that were supporting the president, and that surge actually helped me. I'd like to think that we helped each other in a lot of the areas of this district.
The unofficial results are only a few hours old, but some explanations are starting to emerge for how Davis won so handily in a sprawling district Democrats drew to give themselves a shot. The district contains parts or all of 14 different counties, including college towns like Bloomington Normal and Champaign-Urbana. One reason is that Londrigan's margin of victory shrank in the only three counties she also won in 2018. In Champaign County, which has the most votes, Londrigan's margin margin of victory shrank from over 69% down to 67%. A similar thing happened in McLean County and in Sangamon County, which includes her hometown of Springfield. And turnout apparently fell among Illinois State University students who live in the 13th District. Turnout was 64% and 69% at the two precincts that vote on campus. That's down from the 70s during the last presidential election 4 years ago. It's unclear exactly why. Lane Crothers has a theory. He's a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. He says some college students just aren't on campus right now because they're learning remotely from their permanent residences due to the pandemic.
Typically, communities that have universities in them tend to be bluer than the societies around them, and I don't think that was quite as true this cycle. And I think that's across the United States, and I think that's because we had many fewer college students at college this year.
During his victory speech, Davis acknowledged his college town volunteers.
The kids who've been working this campaign in our college campuses, they did a great job. They busted their butts throughout this district.
Davis also ran up the score in the more rural parts of the district, expanding his margins from 2018 just about everywhere. In Christian County, that includes his hometown of Taylorville, Davis's margin grew from 73% to nearly 76%. Similar thing happened in DeWitt County and in Macon County, which includes Decatur. The Davis campaign touted its ground game as one key factor in the victory, had over 500 volunteers making over a million voter contacts, including 275,000 door knocks. It's unclear how significantly the pandemic impacted Londrigan's campaign and its ground game. Davis himself contracted and fought COVID during the course of the campaign. Londrigan spoke to supporters the morning after.
This was always going to be a tough race, and then a pandemic hit and started throwing curveball after curveball, but you never wavered. Running a congressional campaign is difficult in the best of circumstances. Running one virtually, wow.
Airwaves in the 13th were filled with aggressive attack ads from both campaigns and their supporters.
Mike Madigan is the most corrupt politician in Illinois, and Betsy Londrigan is part of Madigan's machine.
Those ads trying to link Londrigan to Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan through the support she received from his Democratic Party of Illinois apparently worked. That's according to McLean County Republican Party Chair Connie Beard. She says that outweighed any messaging coming in from national Democrats.
They underestimated the Illinois voters' disdain for Mike Madigan. And I think when that it was obvious and clear, her connection with him, I think that damaged her a lot.
It wasn't just Davis either. Republicans did well in U.S. House races around the country. NPR reports Democrats are expected to keep control of the House, but Republicans will make gains. Here's Davis on election night.
I am so proud of the race that we won. I'm so proud of how many races Republicans have won when all the prognosticators said we were going to lose a substantial number of House seats. We haven't seen that play out yet, but there's still a lot of time left.
Lane Crothers, the ISU professor, says another big difference is that Londrigan's narrower loss in 2018, that came in a year when Democrats were disproportionately mobilized. That's how they won the House majority that year. But in 2020, Republicans were energized too. And Crothers says the 13th district, because of how it's drawn, is inherently Republican. I'm Ryan Denham.
The pandemic has forced many faith leaders out of the pulpit and into the homes of many via computer screens and other devices. But for some worshipers, internet sermons just aren't enough. Yvonne Booz explains.
The King James Version of the Bible says, quote, "And he said unto them, Go ye unto all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." That's Mark chapter 16, verse 15. Walter Blaylock is the senior pastor of the Living Gospel Church of God in Christ located in Elgin. His ministry started in the streets more than 30 years ago.
So when the pandemic hit, I asked my audio people, are we ready to have service in the parking lot?
And that's just what they did. Janine Smith Underwood used to live in Elgin, but now stays in Round Lake. She says she's been a member of the congregation for 30 years. She explains that online worship services are difficult for her because she likes being around people.
I like coming here. You know, this is my ministry. This is my church home. But I needed to feel safe. So I feel very safe because I'm out in my car.
Rebecca White Newgren is the pastor of the Second First Church in Rockford. Her church went digital right away after the onset of the pandemic. But when Illinois went into phase 4 of the Restore Illinois plan, She says they decided to have service outside in front of a recent community mural at the church.
And it was lovely and beautiful. And then we realized it was just harder to drag all of those sound cards through the grass. And so we moved to the parking lot.
Newgren explains that the crowd gathered in a large circle. Those who participated in the service stayed in the middle, and everyone else sat in chairs about 10 feet apart. She adds that some people stayed in their cars during the service. Blaylock's setup was similar this summer. Audio equipment was set up in the parking lot, much like an outdoor concert. He preached in front of a small podium as the crowd interacted. Blowing car horns took the place of people saying amen and other encouraging words. Outside worship seems like the perfect setup during a pandemic, but what happens when the weather changes? Newgren says that since temperatures dropped, about 10 people are welcomed inside of the church. The rest have to watch online. She shares that Second First is trying to figure out a way to continue outdoor services.
We've got to figure out the technology of it, but I hope to be able to preach as long as I can in this frigid temperature outside.
Blaylock says the cold weather won't cover his outreach with frostbite. He plans to continue outdoor services even during glove and hat season. He explains that those in Elgin can tune their FM dial and listen right from their cars. This past Sunday morning, Blaylock preached inside the Elgin church due to personal reasons. Some parishioners joined him, while a few stayed in their cars. A few minutes before the service ended, church member Glenn Miller came out of the building with a bucket. He handed out church literature and collected offerings from those sitting in their cars. Miller has been a member of the Elgin church for about 12 years. He says he will continue to come to service, even if it is in the parking lot.
As long as I feel that I'm still safe, I'll come out. But at the same time, I just miss being with my fellow saints as well. So even saying that, I still try to maintain the 6 feet distance and still wear my mask.
The temperature in Elgin was 37 degrees on the first Sunday in November. And as time goes on, temperatures will drop even lower. But for many churchgoers, neither cold temperatures nor a pandemic will keep them at home. I'm Yvonne Booz.
University of Illinois professor David Merriman has compared Illinois and neighboring states on whether COVID-19 restrictions affect the financial condition of small businesses. Maureen McKinney spoke with him.
Can you speak to the report findings that small businesses seem to fare poorly during COVID, no matter how stringent the restrictions were in that state?
I looked at data about the impact of COVID-19, or really the experience of states in the Midwest, Illinois and surrounding states, and I looked at data relevant to how small business did. And for, you know, all of those areas, all of the states, there was a significant impact where small businesses said that they had a, you know, that it had a large negative effect on their economic conditions. And Illinois really did not look different than the other states in the area. For example, Iowa, Indiana, Kentucky, and other states. And some of those states, for example, Iowa never imposed a stay-at-home order at all. And some of those states imposed stay-at-home orders earlier than Illinois, and some imposed them later. And I didn't find any difference really in the severity of the economic stress in the Midwest. Over time, that economic stress went, you know, diminished to some extent, but it did not, there was no evidence that it correlated with the extent of the restrictions on economic trade.
Which states were involved in the study?
So Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Missouri, and Wisconsin.
Do you believe that there's some reason why this is so?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic evidence, and this isn't specific to my study, but other studies as well, seem to suggest that a lot of what happens is that, you know, people are scared of getting COVID-19. And so when they basically, particularly, and this is, I should say, you know, my data stopped sort of in early May. So people were just avoiding commercial activities in general. And they were looking at how severe the disease was and making choices to avoid what they considered dangerous situations. Seems to be. I mean, I don't have direct evidence of that. That seems to be what was going on, though.
What types of businesses did the study cover?
You know, mostly we're talking about restaurants, bars, bookstores, daycare centers, hair salons, most other commercial establishments. That's what I say in the piece.
Did you look at what the consequences are likely for those businesses?
I wasn't able to do that. I mean, there were significant declines in revenue for these businesses. I mean, many of them shut down completely, so they weren't even open. And I looked at counties that where there was an Illinois county that bordered a county in another state, and I compared Illinois' experience to the border counties. And on both sides of the border, we saw significant declines in the number of merchants that were open relative to what we would expect. So declines on the order of 40% in, you know, in early March, you'd see that many closings. And then revenue declines actually were even greater than revenue declines of 50 and 60% for that period. I think that evidence is pretty convincing that the Illinois counties that bordered neighboring counties, you know, look quite similar. It's not only the states that are similar, but the border counties look similar to their border pair. We don't know how many of these businesses, or I was not able to study how many of these businesses, you know, got some support through the federal programs. And I don't know what the long-term effect on these businesses will be. The short-term effects were very severe.
You had said that more research is needed. What needs to be looked at?
We need to know what the long-term effects is. We need to know how much the federal and state supports might have helped these businesses. You know, the extent to which businesses in low-income areas were hurt versus businesses in more well-off areas. Minority businesses were hurt versus other kinds of businesses. And you know, then I think coming out of this, one thing I think I'm very anxious to see studied is once COVID is better controlled, what kinds of policies will allow businesses to come back and flourish?
Do you think that says anything about whether tougher restrictions have more of an effect or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's kind of arguments on both sides here. I mean, the people that want tougher restrictions might say, well, you know, this proves that the restrictions didn't matter that much because people can kind of decide on their own. On the other hand, I think people were realizing this was a dangerous situation, and that suggests that, you know, we don't want the people who are kind of more, you know, less risk averse, more willing to take chances to infect the rest of us. So it doesn't really clearly say whether tougher restrictions are appropriate or not. I think those people who are pro-restriction are going to say, look, this is a very dangerous situation, and we have to kind of discourage people from acting in ways that will endanger the rest of us.
Can you tell me a little bit about what methods you used in the study to come up with the findings?
Yeah, so there were two data sources. One was a very quick new set of surveys that the Department of Census, the U.S. Census, put out. So they surveyed businesses in different states about their reactions to COVID, and they did it very rapidly. And so I was able to use that data to compare across states. The other new data set was put out by a group at Harvard called Opportunity Insights. And they were able to get private sector data on credit card transactions. Primarily, I used that data to compare counties in Illinois with counties in other states. And so that each of those data sources is imperfect in lots of ways, and that's discussed in the report as to what they tell us. But I believe the overall findings are quite credible.
That's University of Illinois Professor David Merriman talking about his study comparing Illinois and neighboring states on whether COVID-19 restrictions affect the financial condition of small businesses. You can find a link to his report at statewideshow.com. Statewide continues in a moment. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Hunters use lead shot to cull the deer population, often with shotguns. Lead is poisonous, and a new study done by two Illinois Wesleyan University professors shows lead makes it into a lot of processed venison, and that's a bad thing. Charlie Schlinker talks with Given Harper and Aaron Schultz Wilson. Given Harper says the odds are pretty good there's lead in that venison.
So we found in 27 firearm harvested ground venison packets from 10 different deer, we found lead fragments in actually 48% of the packets.
Also, the size of the fragments is actually fairly small. I think that that's why they don't get noticed during the processing of the deer and don't get removed. Any exposure to lead is bad. There's no, as far as we know, there is no bottom limit to where you can say, well, if you eat this much lead, you're okay. It just, and the more we study it, the further down that bottom kind of goes, that bottom threshold.
How fast does lead leach into a person's system? So if, for instance, if one were to have a meal of deer or venison with lead shot into it, is that going to stay in the body longer and be absorbed more than, say, chips of lead paint among children, which is the more commonly known problem for lead?
The fragments are not going to be taken up, this whole amount of lead in a like a little fragment of lead shot. It's not going to be taken up by the body very efficiently. And in fact, adults only take up about 15%, somewhere in there, of the lead that they ingest. On the other hand, children who are exposed to lead, children's body are better at assimilating that lead, and they're going to take up about 50% or half the lead that they ingest. Once it's in your system, it can stay for a long time. It can get into your bones.
What made you want to tackle this problem? What made you want to look at it, Given?
Actually, I am a deer hunter. I had read papers about lead contamination in venison, but that was with hunters using rifles. And of course, in Illinois, hunters use mostly shotguns, some muzzle loaders. So I was curious. And so I decided to get some venison packets from different hunters to what extent that lead contamination was in the ground venison from shotgun slugs.
48% seems like a lot. It would seem like a hazard that might have been noticed earlier.
Yeah, again, most of the studies, though, had been done with rifle bullets, and those bullets travel at a faster rate of speed and tend to fragment more than shotgun slugs.
What do most hunters hunt with?
So in Illinois, it's about 90% of the deer that have been killed over the past several years have been harvested with shotguns.
So is there likely a need to require a change in the production of ammunition? And how would that play out in the legislature or among hunters? It sounds like it might be more expensive to have steel slugs.
You know, there's non-toxic, non-lead ammunition available. And based on the results of our study, certainly we would encourage hunters to try to use those non-toxic ammunition.
Are there comparable studies in other states that replicate this result?
We started looking at some of those other studies. So there have been studies in Canada, and there have been studies in Europe, are primarily where we were able to get numbers, so amount of lead or concentration of lead. Whereas studies from the United States, there have been some great studies looking at the presence of fragments, but not as many studies saying, okay, once we found a fragment, this is how much lead was actually in the meat.
Is it likely that there needs to be regulation? I mean, lead is cheaper and lead is traditional. Is that something we just need to move away from?
I know the state of California has enacted a lead ammunition ban. And one of the major problems encountered there was that the endangered California condors, that was their major mortality issue, is that they were feeding on carcasses with that had been, the animals had been killed with lead ammunition, and they were dying of lead poisoning.
What are you going to do with this study? What's next?
We hope that it will increase awareness, especially among hunters, because the concern about their health and the health of their families. But I think also there's another issue as well, is that there has been a statewide program of hunters donating deer to food pantries. You know, there may be a concern there too. I also want to point out, certainly we're not arguing against hunting. For years, I used lead ammunition, but once I discovered this, I've switched to non-toxic ammunition. So hunting is vital in controlling the deer population.
The paper in the Bulletin of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology is Lead Contamination in Ground Venison from Shotgun-Harvested White-Tailed Deer in Illinois. The lead authors are Illinois Wesleyan University's Aaron Schultz-Wilson and Given Harper, along with Genevieve Alexander, Minori Perara, and veterinarian Matt Fraker of Bloomington Normal.
Their paper also notes that meat processors tend to mix meat from multiple deer when they grind venison, and that may also further fragment the lead shot. Deer season begins November 20th here in Illinois. Earlier in the show, we talked about some of the election results, including the graduated income tax proposal that was on the ballot, a proposal to change the state's constitution. It failed to get enough support. Tony Arnold of member station WBEZ has been following that issue. And Tony, from your vantage point, what happened there?
What happened is that voters overwhelmingly rejected it. There were two paths to victory here to passing it. Based on how the Illinois Constitution allows for it to be amendments to be ratified. And one of them is a clean and simple 60% of the vote in favor of the amendment. The other is a majority of all ballots cast. And it ended up not even coming close to neither one. And in fact, majority of people voted against the proposed amendment. So as of, it just overwhelmingly voters said no to this amendment.
A lot of money, as we know, was put into this race, money that was coming really from just a couple of sources. We saw TV ad after TV ad, both for and against.
For one thing, this is by far the most expensive ballot measure in Illinois history. Nothing comes even close. More than $100 million in total were raised for this fight, a little more than $50 million on one side, a little more than $50 million on the other side. And almost all that money comes from two people. Governor J.B. Pritzker wanted it and put more than $50 million of his own money into it. Ken Griffin is a billionaire hedge fund firm CEO and founder. He didn't want it. And so he put all a bunch of money into the other side. And together they put so much money into this that this ballot measure is one of the most expensive ones in U.S. history. Only a few races in California top it. So with that in mind, if you saw any ads or messaging about this on your TV or in your mailbox, it probably came from money from either Ken Griffin or J.B. Pritzker. And the messaging there was on the anti side was, do you really trust Springfield to spend more of your money? And I think that that might have had a pretty effective label to it. I think the other thing is, if at a fundamental level, when you're talking about taxes, people are going to be automatically just kind of be reticent to support anything. And I think that, those two things combined with the pandemic and a lot of uncertainty in the world anyway, just all led up to this formula of people saying no.
Since Governor J.B. Pritzker took office a couple of years ago, his big push was for this. This was the way he was going to bring in over $3 billion, he was estimating, to the state budget. And a lot of people I've talked to said, you know, he's putting a lot of eggs in one basket. He's hoping that people will go along with this. And if not, there's going to be some problems. Okay, so now that we know the outcome and he did not come out on top with this issue, what are some of the possibilities going forward? Do we know?
Well, Pritzker's outlined a few different possibilities. One option is that he's already asked his administration, every department, to cut, be prepared to cut 5% from their budgets. That's a start for balancing this current fiscal year's budget over the next 7 months. Another option was in the state budget the legislators gave him. They gave him the authority to borrow, if he wanted to borrow $5 billion. The governor's not done that yet, but he has that option. And then there's a third option that the governor has said, which is raising the flat tax. And that's going to be a heavy lift. I'm curious to see if that's going to be a strong push in the next few months. But without some sort of substantial money, you're coming in from something like raising the flat tax, you're going to be looking at some major cuts to make this budget balanced by the end of the by next June.
Is it a defeat for Pritzker in a sense of hurting his political capital going forward?
It absolutely hurts the governor's political capital. He put you don't just run for governor and put an amendment like this on the ballot to see it fail and then walk away unscathed. That said, you know, the governor, he still has had popular, well-positioned stances on dealing with the pandemic. And people have, for the most part, supported what he has done and everything that I've seen, even if there's grumbles about how he's handled the recent closures of indoor dining at restaurants and bars. And so I think that, you know, this is an instance where if it weren't for the pandemic, I used to say that the governor's political reputation was on the line on this question. I think the pandemic has changed that formula along with the presidential race. And I'm curious to see if he runs for re-election again. He has not said what he intends to do. And when I posed that question to him earlier this year, he said he didn't really acknowledge yes or no one way or the other what his own political plans were. But by and large, he is the face of the Democratic Party of Illinois, and not only the face of it, but also its bank, and has contributed so much of his own money that so many Democrats have turned to him for support, for financial support.
He's also been pushing very heavily for Congress, maybe hoping for a Democratic Congress and also a Democratic president who would work out some type of agreement to provide quite a bit of money to Illinois to help offset some of its losses that it's had during the pandemic. Not sure if that's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to play out. That leaves everything up in the air. Right now, he is really in limbo, isn't he?
He is in limbo, and to your point, Congress, it's not clear at all. Nobody's putting any stakes right now into what Congress is going to do, and if it does do something, how much is that going to be for the state of Illinois? Either way, it'd be a one-time fix, right? This is a one-time dash of money to this would be the one-time dash of money to the state, as opposed to something sustainable. Or long-term, like what the graduated income tax would have brought to a state budget. So I think with the presidential race still up in the air, including many congressional seats and Senate seats, I just don't see Congress taking this up in the next couple weeks, and that just leads to more uncertainty about what the state's going to do. You're already seeing bond rating agencies that have been watching the state's budget put out statements today, kind of laying out the terms here about the state's got to do something here or else they're going to be in some really big trouble.
That's Tony Arnold, a reporter with WBEC. We've been talking about the graduated income tax amendment on the Illinois ballot, which failed to win approval. Springfield is now one of a handful of Illinois cities that will fine individuals for not wearing a mask at local businesses. Mary Hansen has more on that.
The city council approved a $50 fine for people not wearing a covering over their nose and mouth at retail establishments. Here's Springfield Police Chief Kenny Winslow.
It's about taking some of that responsibility off of the businesses and putting it on to people and their individual decisions.
Winslow says he's heard from business owners whose employees are yelled at for trying to enforce the mask mandate. The ordinance also means businesses could face up to a $500 fine for not requiring customers to comply. The fine for individuals comes as local officials grapple with how to address a spike in COVID-19 cases. I'm Mary Hansen.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We'll be back next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past shows, you can find them all at statewideshow.com. And our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.